Welcome to the Terrorist Therapist Show on Renegade Talk Radio with your host, Dr. Carol. Though you may not realize that the ongoing threat of terrorism is affecting your life and that of your loved ones. Each week, Dr. Carol analyzes the hottest topics in terror and helps you and your family reach your dreams despite living in a time of terror.
Paris attacks were the canary in the coal mine, and we'd better listen. Welcome to the Terrorist Therapist Show. I'm Dr. Carol, a psychiatrist, and your terrorist therapist. Well, how could I not pick this as the topic for this week's Terrorist Therapist Show, when in fact, November 13th was the sixth anniversary of the Paris attacks. These attacks were like their 9/11. And just like our 9/11 taught us that those who forget history are doomed to repeat it, same thing goes for the Paris attacks, but not necessarily just for Paris. Really, it's for all Western countries, of course, including the United States. Now, I'm going to talk to you today. I'm going to take us back in time, but not just for the sake of, you know, old time's sake, you know, talking about some of the things that happened and what that attack was like, although I am going to talk about that to some degree. But it is also to make the point that there are numerous things that happened, why that happened at that time, that are alike things that are happening in the United States today. I mean, I have talked in previous podcasts about why we are more at risk today than we were before 9/11. But now I'm going to be talking about the ones that specifically relate or are similar to things that were happening in Paris and why the terrorists attacked at that time. Now this ISIS has taken responsibility for the Paris attacks. So there's not any question. And the people involved have pledged their loyalty to ISIS and so on. There's no question as to who was behind it. So now, the question is, can the Paris attacks happen here? And the answer is, oui, oui. Oh, God, that's so tacky, but I couldn't resist. Yes, yes. There are definitely reasons why it could happen here that, as I was saying, relate to similarities in Paris. Now, first of all, the people who were the terrorists of that attack stated that they were angry at Paris, the killings of Muslims in the Middle East by the French. And in particular, they blamed the French president and so on for participating in attacks in the Middle East on Muslims. And of course, needless to say, the United States has participated in attacks in the Middle East, notably in Afghanistan, and of course, with our surrender, our humiliating, horrible surrender in Afghanistan, that has emboldened terrorists of all stripes, you know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Now, another similarity is that in France, in November 2015, the time of their attack, they were on high alert. France was on high alert because of previous terror attacks that had happened in that year in particular. And we are not exactly on high alert, but as many of you probably know, there was a bulletin just released by the Department of Homeland Security, an updated National Terrorism Advisory System bulletin that talks about the heightened threat environment in the United States that we are now in. And I'll get to that at the end of today's show. Another similarity is that the terrorists involved who attacked Paris were able to make them to slip in. One, because most of them came from Belgium or France, so they, you know, were there or in the environment nearby. but also because, even though in some of them were on terrorist watch lists, but they were able to hide amongst the many migrants crossing the borders into France. And many of them were returning from the Middle East at that time. And so they slipped in, you know, yes, there were, some of them were on police watch lists and so on, but they managed to hide amongst these other people, migrants from the Middle East. Well, of course, what do we have here today in America? There are migrants from coming across the southern border, and there are Afghans, not all of whom are friendly, coming in planes, brought over, not crossing illegally or whatever, but brought over by American planes. And yes, of course, I have to say that that some of them were friendly and helpful to our troops in Afghanistan, and they deserved to be rescued. But there was certainly no question that there were jihadists amongst them, hiding amongst them, just like what happened in Paris. Okay, now I should mention that I lived in Paris for 3 years, and I've been back to Paris fairly recently, so I know what I'm talking about. In fact, when I went back to Paris in 2018, because my book Lions and Tigers and Terrorists, Oh My, won the Paris Book Festival Award. So I was there, and I have seen the change in France and in Paris. So it's with that background that I'm able to talk about the Paris attacks, you know, in more depth. So let me just first a general outline of what happened. There were a series of coordinated terrorist attacks, three main parts of Paris were attacked on November 13th, a Friday night, starting in the evening, starting with the National Stadium, the Stade de France, where there was a football match going on between France and Germany. And three suicide bombers struck outside the Stade de France. They had planned to go inside, but for various reasons, they weren't allowed in, so they unleashed, you know, detonated their vests outside. And what happened was the three terrorists were killed and one passerby. Then there was another group of terrorists, three terrorists, who, so there were nine terrorists altogether, and then there was a man called the 10th man, who we're going to talk about in a little more detail in the next segment. And so this next group attacked the area in Paris where there were lots of crowded cafes and restaurants. And they were, one of them blew himself up and unleashed a suicide vest, and the others were shooting people at these cafes. Then, of course, the most well-known part of this attack was the third group, who carried out a mass shooting and took hostages at a concert at the Bataclan Theater. It was a concert, a rock concert, where there were 1,500 people, and some of those were taken as hostages. So they were shot, and then some of the terrorists blew themselves up with suicide vests and so on, and ultimately the police raided the theater and saved the hostages. But in this whole attack, in these three attacks essentially, there were 130 people who were killed, and this included 90 at the Bataclan, and there were hundreds of people who were injured. You know, some assessments say 400 and some odd people, others say 600 and some odd people, hundreds. And of the, there's so much to talk about. It's hard to, now these attacks had been planned in Syria, and they were organized by a terrorist cell based in Belgium, based in a city called Molenbeek, which is outside of Brussels. And I went to medical school in Belgium and lived in Belgium for 3 years, approximately. And so I am very well familiar with Molenbeek, actually, which is a very, you know, shady, poor part of Belgium, and where terrorism, even since 2015, you know, before and after 2015, that is a hotspot today, even. That is the hotspot in Europe for terrorists. So what happened was many of the people, even though most of the people who were the terrorists, these nine terrorists, or 10 really, including the 10th man, they were born in France or Belgium. There were some who were born outside, but many of them had gone to the Middle East and had become radicalized and returned to Europe amongst the migrants and refugees from Syria. So, I actually, when I went to Paris in 2018, I purposely made an effort and managed to get into the Bataclan. I wanted to, it turned out, it's a whole other story that I won't go into because it's too long, but the performance was sold out, and I had to go through a whole rigmarole to manage to get in. And I did it because I wanted to feel what it would have felt like to be sitting in the theater when these terrorists attacked. And it was just a chilling experience, because the Bataclan is a beautiful theater, and there are seats on the ground floor, and then there are also balconies. And during this attack, some of the people were killed who were in the balconies, not just they were killed, you know, on the ground floor, but they were also killed in the balconies. And those people, when they died, they fell over the balconies and landed on the people on the ground floor. I mean, it was just a tragic event. I mean, all of it was tragic, but, and the theater is relatively small. And so the music is loud, and you're sitting really literally rubbing shoulders with the person next to you. The seats are tiny, and the theater is super dark. So when the terrorists came into the theater, it was like shooting fish in a barrel, because, you know, and that's what they did, but, you know, shot, 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 you know, just bang, bang, bang. And that's how they were able to kill so many people. And then, of course, took the hostages, and they were trying to negotiate with the president. Anyhow, it was just a whole devastating event. So now in the next segment, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about, at this time, this period of time right now is not only the sixth anniversary of the November 2015 Paris attacks. It is also a time when in Paris, the trial is going on of the people who are still alive, who were involved in the attacks. Now, I'm going to talk to you in the next segment particularly about some of the people who were the attackers, and about the one who is still alive and who was directly involved. This is the 10th man. Well, I'll tell you who he was when we come back. So stay tuned. Welcome back to the Terrorist Therapist Show, where we're talking today about the Paris attacks, where the canary in the coal mine, and we'd better listen. Well, we're talking about the Friday, the 13th of November, 2015, those attacks in Paris that took place at the places that I was just talking to you about. and the trial is going on, and the main, the best well-known person in the trial is a man named Salah Abdeslam, and he was trying to be quiet. You know, he kept quiet. He was arrested. He was a man who managed to survive. There were only two people who managed to survive the attacks of November 13th, who were terrorists. The other person was not as directly involved. So he's been sort of considered the main person who was directly involved. And I'll tell you how he was directly involved. But he kept quiet. He ran away. He escaped right after the attack in Paris. He escaped to Belgium, and then he, you know, there was this big manhunt, and he was eventually captured. And so, and then he was tried in Belgium, and then he was also transferred to Paris so that he could stand trial there. And when he did talk at the trial in Paris, the trial is still going on. It's going to be going on for months. And when he did talk in Paris, he identified himself as a soldier of the Islamic State. So there, you know, he's not trying to say he's not guilty. There's no way that any of them really can say that he's not, that they're not guilty, but they are on trial. Now, Salah Abdeslam was born in Brussels, and as I said, he's the only surviving member of the group directly involved. His involvement was that he provided logistical support for the nine people who were, you know, detonating their vests and shooting people in the Paris attack. So he did things like drive people to their target locations, and he had and basically setting things up, reserving hotel rooms and so on. And there is also said that he had some involvement in the manufacture of the explosives. Now, he actually, all the other people who were involved in the attacks either killed themselves, you know, with their vests and so on, or they were killed by the French and Belgian police officers. Belgian police officers, you know, were captured. Some of the people in Belgium after they escaped from Paris. Or actually one of them was still in Belgium. He was the one who went to Syria. I will tell you about him. Now, let me call him Salah. No, Abdeslam. Was born in Brussels, as I said. His parents were immigrants. They came from Morocco, and they came from Morocco. They had gotten French nationality when they were in Algeria, and then they moved to Belgium. And this area of Belgium, Molenbeek, which is an area where lots of migrants from countries that, you know, terrorists, where there are a lot of terrorists. And they congregate in this area, and it's kind of like people joining gangs. You know, they influence each other, and many of them started off with sort of, nondescript or ordinary childhood. Some of them, they weren't all poor. But they were influenced by each other, and they developed an anger towards society. So, for example, the person who Abdeslam became best friends with in childhood was the man who was the mastermind of the Paris attacks. And his name was Abdelhamid Abu Abuad. You know, no matter how many times I practice saying these names before I go get on to tell you about them, that's not my, I don't have a talent for it. Abuad. Abdelhamid, let's go with that. So they were best friends. And they, you know, had normal not normal childhoods, but they didn't start off as terrorists, let's put it that, like that. But they did, like, for example, Abdesalam was a mechanic. And he went to school, he liked football, he liked motorbikes, he was a mechanic. But then he started to get into, become partners with Abdelhamid in crime. And this first, it was petty crime. They went from petty crime to Paris, and they stayed friends. And Abu'ud went to Syria and became radicalized and came back to Belgium and got Abdesalam involved in terrorism, involved in this whole plot to attack Paris. And they at the time of the attack, so they Abdesalam and his brother worked in a cafe in Paris, in Molenbeek. They were having a relative, I won't say normal life, but I'll say a relatively ordinary life. And Abdesalam became manager of a bar named Le Beguin in Molenbeek. And his brother owned it. He was the manager. And then the bar was closed. See, this is so interesting because there's always something that, you know, gets people. I mean, here, he was convicted of lots of petty crimes with the man who became the mastermind of the Paris attack. So, you know, during these, I mean, you can see a whole, psychologically, you can see a whole connection here. There was this antisocial environment, you know, or antisocial attitude that got him involved in petty crimes in the first place. And, you know, in Belgium, I mean, it just like in many other places, even though they had an ordinary life and they weren't necessarily poor or starving in any case, they saw around them, they felt marginalized. And they saw around them in Belgium people who were living a more comfortable lifestyle. And so this is how the petty crimes began. And then this is where I was going. The bar, you know, and a lot of the people who were involved in the Paris attacks one way or another actually were friends who met at this bar. And so then at some point right before the attacks, not long before the attacks, the authorities closed the bar, because they discovered that drugs were being sold there, used and sold there. And so the brother sold the bar about 6 weeks before the Paris attacks. So now, you know, society, now they really were angry, right? Now they were doing okay, you know, at this bar. They had their friends, they were managing, they were making a decent living. And then what happened? These big bad people in the society in Belgium, you know, the authorities closed their shop, closed their bar. So now there are so many interesting things about his life. You know, one of the things he did, Abdesalam used the website booking.com to rent rooms for the terrorists who went to Paris. And he also helped by renting cars. He rented flats. He rented the hotel rooms, as I said. And so he was the logistics man. Although it's interesting, because one of the people who was an associate of his testified that he heard him claiming that he had shot people in Paris. Now, whether he did or not, probably at the trial going on now, he's not going to say that. You know, so did he, or was he just bragging because he, you know, didn't want to be the one that, you know, the one that didn't shoot people or kill people? There's also sort of a mystery about a discarded suicide belt that was found to have sweat on it that matched the DNA of the sweat on the belt matched the DNA of Abdesalam. Now here's another interesting factoid. He has fans. You know, this happened in 2015. He was caught in 2016. And so he's been in jail, whether it's the Belgian jail or the French jail, you know, for several years. And he receives incessant mail, notably from French and Belgian women who profess their love to him and tell him that they want to bear his child. So it's just like in America. You know, just like pretty much in lots of countries, where, you know, these bad guys, these bad boys, who are attractive to certain kinds of women who have had problems with their father. That's a whole other story. But anyhow, just like Cruz, Nicholas Cruz, you know, in Florida, the Valentine's Day killer, school shooter, he has had for years and years, he's had women, you know, professing their love and wanting to marry him and all this kind of stuff. And we've had other, you know, there have been lots of other famous criminals, killers, who have had gotten the same reaction. And when Salah Abdesalam went to Paris, the Paris prison, when he was sent to Paris, the prisoners in Paris cheered for him. When they captured him in Belgium, the people in the neighborhood all came out and they were throwing things at the police. They were really angry that they were capturing him, you know, because they identify with him and they didn't think that they thought what he did was great. Well, all right. Now let me, there's so much to tell you. Let me end this segment now. And when we come back, I'm going to talk to you about the current state of Paris, which, as I said, I had a chance to see firsthand when I went to Paris in 2018. And it has only gotten worse, you know, news that we've heard from Paris. The situation has only gotten worse. And I'm going to tell you more about what it is and how we need to look at this and ask how much of this is now going to happen in America. So stay tuned. Welcome back to the Terrorist Therapist Show, where we're talking about Paris attacks with a canary in the coal mine, and we'd better listen. Talking about this because of the sixth anniversary of the Paris attacks, the November 13th Paris attacks of 2015. And I just want to, I know I was a little off, but I think I was a little off, but I just want to correct. I was talking about the two main figures in these Paris attacks, Salah Abdesalam, and the mastermind, his childhood friend, partners in petty crime, from petty crime to Paris attacks, Abdelhamid Abaoud. That was pretty close to what I was saying before. Anyway, what's more important is the content here. Next, now I want to talk to you about what is going on in Paris today in terms, and you will see for yourself the similarities to what is happening or what is about to happen, what is increasingly happening in the United States. So now, the Daily Mail, the United Kingdom's Daily Mail, reported just recently that two-thirds of French people think white European Christian populations are being threatened with extinction by immigration from Muslim and African countries. And they said that such a scenario will definitely or probably play out. Now, this poll was conducted to test the belief in the idea of what's called in French, in fact, it was a Frenchman, a French author, originally wrote about this. It's called Le Grand Remplacement, the Great Replacement. And it is actually this concept, sociological political concept, is currently being touted by a man named Eric Zemmour, and he is trying to become unseat Macron in next year's election. And this is the idea of this is that the political elites are bringing massive numbers of immigrants into places, Western civilization, where there are free societies, in order to subvert them, to create a population that is more amenable to authoritarianism and more easily controlled. You know, like what's happening here with the vaccine mandates and the lockdowns and so on. Now, if you talk about this, if you say this, like I am risking being, called an Islamophobe, a racist, a hate monger, a conspiracy theorist. You know, actually, I looked this up on, you never can trust Wikipedia. And I wanted to read more about it and see if I could explain it, in a simpler way. So what does it say when you look up Great Replacement in Wikipedia? It says, Great Replacement, French Grand Remplacement, also known as replacement theory, is a white nationalist conspiracy theory, which states that with the complicity or cooperation of replacist elites, the white French population, as well as white European populations at large, is being demographically and culturally replaced with non-European peoples, specifically Arab, Berber, Turkish, and sub-Saharan Muslim populations through mass migration, demographic growth, and a European drop in the birth rate. Now, you can call this a conspiracy theory, but you can also look up the demographics, and this is not made up. This is happening. Now, this originally was made popular by a French author named Renaud Camus. He wrote a book in 2011 called Le Grand Remplacement, and it specifically associated the presence of Muslims in France with this potential danger and destruction of French culture and civilization. Well, let me, and of course the part, I mean, that is happening. I guess the conspiracy theory, the part that is mainly thought to be conspiracy theory is the fact that not that this isn't true, demographically and so on, but that it's being done intentionally by globalists, by global and liberal elites who purposely want this to happen. Well, I'm not making this up. And people who, and this author isn't making this up. It has been happening. And as I was trying to say, this man, this politician, Eric Zemmour, some might be consider him a right wing pundit. He is going to have a lot. He already has a lot of people who are supporting him, because people who are native French people have been getting increasingly upset about what this mass immigration, it's not about tolerance, and it's not really about Islamophobia. It's what's been happening to France. And there are more, there's a sense that the French, because there are so many people who are, and so many radical, or so many, now again, this is not about, I always have to say this, not all terrorists are Muslims, and certainly not all Muslims are terrorists, okay? But the people who are have been invading France and also the UK, and you have to wonder why, and Germany for that matter, and you know, those are the main European countries that have opened their doors to migrants and to people coming. I mean, this is how the Paris attacks happened. The people came back from the people went to Syria and the Middle East because they wanted to become radicalized. They became radicalized. They came back to Europe and they radicalized other people. And that's how the attacks happened in Paris, as I was explaining. And of course, it wasn't just these two, you know, the two best friends that I was talking about. There were others, and mainly the people, or a lot of the people who met together in this cafe. You know, they were hatching these plans. So that's how it spreads. And so now there's a Roman Catholic the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Turkey named Giuseppe Bernardini. Has said this, that the dominion has already begun. He said that he had a conversation with a Muslim leader who said to him, quote, "Thanks to your democratic laws, we will invade you. Thanks to our religious laws, we will dominate you." Now, that is kind of the point. The French authorities are afraid now of the huge Muslim population. You know, the French people are the minority, and a lot of the obviously not all Muslims in France or anyplace else are terrorists, but there are a lot of Muslims in radicalized, let's put it that way, there are a lot of radicalized Muslims in France who have been doing attacks. You know, there are attacks happening all the time. We just don't hear about it in American mainstream media. But there are churches that are attacked. There are people, women who are being raped. I mean, I am aware of all of these things. And so it is becoming, you know, the French people are becoming more and more frightened. Police in France are being killed. So in France, many imams in France have said the same thing as what I was talking about, this archbishop in Turkey. I don't know why he was interviewed by the UK Daily Mail, but he was. But it's the same thing. Actually, the imams in France are saying the same thing. Now, there's this French politician named Marion Maréchal, and she is saying that France's first major challenge is the most vital, and she's talking about Le Grand Remplacement. This demographic countdown, which already makes us realize the possibility of becoming a minority on the land of our ancestors. That's what she talks about. And she says, after 40 years of mass migration, Islamic lobbies, and political correctness, that France is losing its ability to be French and to, you know, enact its laws. And this is the problem. France has welcomed a large and growing population of people, among whom are many who have absolute contempt for French law and no intention of obeying it, and who believe that they have a responsibility before Allah to replace that French law with Islamic law as soon as it's possible to do so. I mean, that is the problem. It's that in admitting all, just opening the doors to everybody, just like we did to the Afghans, in not having any, literally not having any boundaries, not vetting people, just letting everybody come in, they're not being careful to not let in the jihadists. And that's exactly what is happening in America. So, you know, that is the problem. I mean, so for, if you were at the beginning of the show, if you were thinking to yourself, huh, what happened in Paris in 2015 would never happen here, think again. Now, especially, I'm going to close with this bulletin from the Homeland Security, this National Terrorism Advisory System bulletin, said that there is currently in America a, quote, heightened threat environment. They talk about domestic violent extremists. Unfortunately, you know, they even admit in this, where is it? They admit that they have prioritized. I mean, they are actually in the section saying that says how we are responding. They admit in this bulletin, DHS, Department of Homeland Security, has prioritized combating domestic violent extremist threats within its Homeland Security grant program. In other words, they are prioritizing in using counterterrorism money to pay attention to worry about, to counteract domestic terrorists. And I in a previous podcast, I talked about how they were doing that. They were considering domestic terrorists the parents who opposed critical race theory and the pornographic sex that was being taught in school. And so so they talk in this bulletin, they talk about how the ongoing foreign terrorists, they talk about foreign terrorist organizations and domestic terrorists are being inspired to follow they're talking about how the domestic terrorists and are inspired by the ongoing pandemic because of the perceived government overreach in implementation of public health safety measures. That's one of the things that are getting the domestic terrorists upset, they say. And then, of course, foreign terrorist organizations and domestic terrorists continue to attempt to inspire potential followers to conduct attacks in the United States, including by exploiting recent events in Afghanistan. Exploiting it. In other words, it's not that what happened in Afghanistan was bad, or not that the American government should be stand responsible for all of that, but the terrorists, would wannabe terrorists, are exploiting that. The what happened in Afghanistan has emboldened terrorists. So anyhow, they are saying they're not aware of an imminent and credible threat to a specific location in the United States. However, as you may well remember, and in my previous podcast, I talk about the threat that there was in Virginia. So there was a threat to a specific place. I mean, it is really, one does have to, unfortunately, look at the bulletins from the Department of Homeland Security with a, I don't want to say cynical, maybe that's me, but with a critical eye. I mean, critical in terms of trying to see what part is real and what part is political. I mean, yes, of course there is a threat to America. I'm not questioning that. In fact, it might really be even stronger than they're putting in this bulletin. But the way that it's being described and the fact that most of the money for counterterrorism is being directed at domestic terrorists who are being called parents who don't like what's being taught in school, amongst others, is very frightening. Anyhow, I know that was a lot. I tried to sort of summarize each of these, the aspects of this. Obviously, I invite you to do further research and look it up yourself. But I gave you a taste of what's going on here and how, you know, we can't just look at Paris and say, tant pis, too bad, c'est tragique. We have to think of it as the future, the potential future of America if we don't wake up. Well, thank you for listening to the Terrorist Therapist Show. I'm Dr. Carol, your terrorist therapist.
If you would like to find out more about terrorism from me, your terrorist therapist, visit my website, terroristtherapist.com. And if you're a parent or teacher and want to build stronger nests for your kids to become more resilient, check out my new award-winning book, Lions and Tigers and Terrorists, Oh My, How to Protect Your Child in a Time of Terror. It's the first and only book about terrorism for kids. You can find it wherever books are sold or directly from the publisher at terrorismforkids.com. Terrorism, the number 4, kids.com. I'm Dr. Carol, your terrorist therapist.
Thank you for listening to the Terrorist Therapist Show on Renegade Talk Radio with your host, Dr. Carol. We hope listening to the show has made you feel calmer, more resilient, and more able to reach your dreams despite living in a time of terror. You can also check out past shows on Renegade Talk Archives for more insights.